Good morning. Just so I get a sense of who's here, and I understand that the topics are varied, so the folks who are here are likely to have different backgrounds. How many of you either have or currently work with court-involved youth or youth who are at risk of being court-involved? Okay. So some of this will be very familiar territory, I'm willing to bet. I need to let you know, in the spirit of candor and ethics, that I actually don't get anything out of talking to you today, except a trip to New Orleans, which is probably well worth the price of admission. So just to make sure that we are having a same conversation, just a little bit of defining the issue in the language. I think I'm preaching to the choir when I suggest that behavioral health disorders are a serious public health concern. We also know that the prevalence of these disorders are not equal through the population. We know that there are higher risk or higher rate groups and others. And we also know that youth who have behavioral health disorders particularly experience higher rates of impaired academic, family, and social functioning, increased number of suicide attempts, court involvement, and recidivism. Interestingly enough, there is some emerging research regarding the correlation of ACEs with likelihood of court involvement, and if the court involvement coming in with co-occurring disorders, coming in with higher rates of academic underachievement and failure, more likely to fail on probation, which is the first step for teeing up a kid to deeper and deeper penetration into the juvenile justice system. And there's some emerging research that suggests that by the time you get to the deepest end of the juvenile justice system, it's a little hard to figure out how they ended up deep end in the juvenile justice system rather than the mental health system, except that they tend to be more male and more of color, with a very deep penetration of kids with behavioral health disorders who are of color and poor into the juvenile justice system, to the point where many of us have begun to suspect, if not actually believe, that the juvenile justice system has essentially become the default forensic mental health system in the United States for large segments of our population. We know that there's a very high prevalence of behavioral health disorders. These are three separate studies done at different times with different populations. They came up with roughly the same very disturbing numbers. This is the number of youth in contact with the juvenile justice system at some point, either from still in the community to deeper in penetrations, who have at least one diagnosable disorder. What's very interesting when you peel the onion back is that most of these youth are not diagnosed exclusively or even primarily with a disruptive behavior disorder. You would expect that the juvenile justice system would be chock full of kids who would warrant diagnoses like conduct disorder, but in fact, that's not typically what we see. We see a greater spread of anxiety disorders, probably reflecting the higher rates of exposure to adversity and trauma, but also mood disorders and other kinds of difficulties. And increasingly, we're seeing the inclusion of youth who have more and more significant learning disabilities and even intellectual disabilities, to the point where you sort of wonder how they were ever competent to stand trial in order to penetrate the system in the first place. And perhaps most disturbingly, almost 30% of these youth have disorders serious enough at the time of the studies that they should have received immediate and significant treatment in a mental health setting, but were being maintained in juvenile justice settings instead. In the 1990s and early 2000s, building upon the adult experience with juvenile drug courts, one response was to try and create specialty problem-solving courts in the form of juvenile drug courts. This was an effort to try and divert from juvenile justice system penetration youth whose problems were mixed up with substance use, and it was an effort to try and get them to be able to stabilize in the community without penetration into facilities-based detention or care. There are now roughly 443, I saw some data recently that suggests we're probably at 458, the juvenile drug courts around the country, and this is just a map of their distribution, with the darker colors representing more prevalence in those jurisdictions. But how good are they, and do they get the kinds of results that we want? The truth of the matter is that this is a great example of research, the good, the bad, and the ugly, but also the hopeful. So the good is that, at least in some studies, we've been able to demonstrate that youth who are enrolled in the juvenile drug court process do well relative to kids who have adjudication as usual. On the other hand, we've had some that suggest that they do nothing at all. More might actually facilitate the passage into the juvenile justice system if they fail out, and one of the consequences of failing out is penetration into detention or commitment to youth authorities. This is probably an artifact of borrowing from the adult model fairly early on, when people were not building into their model of accountability the fact that substance use is characterized by relapse. And so if people continue, especially in the first third or so of treatment, to continue showing up with dirty urines, this is probably par for the course, not necessarily time yet to pull the trigger and declare the intervention to have been not successful. But the truth of the matter is the evidence has been all over the map at this point. Well, when we look at the evidence, we have some folks, like Dr. Marlowe, who will declare that they're ineffective. There are others who say, well, the data is a little more scattered than that. We have some that are effective, some that seem to be inconsequential, and some that seem perhaps even have negative outcomes. And the real interesting issue is, what's the difference between the ones that seem to be effective and those that do nothing or might even be harmful? And at least the research questions going forward are going to be looking at things like, are they actually using evidence-based practices? Do they adhere to the 16 strategies which are supposed to inform the structure and the practice inside of those juvenile drug court settings? And greater attention to the presence of co-occurring mental health and substance use disorders amongst youth in the juvenile justice system. It would make sense, for example, if you have a very high rate of co-occurring disorders and you are sending kids off to substance abuse treatment, that these youth would be more likely to fail out of substance abuse treatment. We've also learned that doing sequential treatment, where you send the kid first to substance abuse or then to mental health, or if you think the mental health problem is the problem, you do it the other way around, isn't particularly effective for co-occurring disorders. And we've also learned that it's not terribly effective for co-occurring youth to be in parallel treatment, where you expect the kid to go to substance abuse counseling or treatment on Tuesday and they go to their mental health treatment on Thursday. If these were youth who were really good at keeping that many appointments, they probably wouldn't be here. But it's important that we pay attention to them, because there's just a whole list of things that are correlated with the presence of a co-occurring disorder. Probably the third bullet point and the fourth bullet point are particularly important to pay attention to, because these are the circumstances which then lead to further penetration into the juvenile justice system. So what can we do about these young people? One of the things that we need to do is to review again and revise eligibility and exclusion criteria to take into account the presence of co-occurring disorders. We need to complement the substance abuse screening and assessment with mental health screening and assessment using validated standardized tools. We need to get much better at youth and family involvement. Remember that the model came from adult drug court, where presumably an adult could stand on their own two feet and make their own decisions. We know that adolescents and youth are deeply contexted in their families and in their peer groups. We need to try and establish the capacity, because this is very, very hard to find in the real world. Find integrated treatment services that take the youth and provide the care that they need. We need to revisit the notion of violation, sanctions, and rewards, and we need to think about whether or not we want to modify the expectations for graduation from a program. So the first thing to do is to simply include these youth with mental disorders. Some have argued for a juvenile mental health court. I am personally not a big fan of that. It seems to me that that's simply creating the two silos that already exist when most of them are customers of both with co-occurring disorders. And we need to avoid using criteria as they've had in the past that are based on specific diagnosis. What's important is not what the used mental health diagnosis is, it's the degree of functional impairment. So I've seen kids who would have been eligible, but they looked like they were having an emerging psychotic disorder. Their emerging psychotic disorder was clinically well controlled, but because they had that label, by rule, they were out. Or some kids in some courts, by rule, if you had post-traumatic stress disorder, you could not be in the juvenile drug court, which to me seems not the point. The point isn't the label. The point is the degree of functional impairment. Can they participate and succeed? We need to develop validated tools, or actually there are some good ones, although we could certainly use more, and using consistent protocols. And for youth who are coming into juvenile courts, I would also advocate universal screening. Youth who are screened positive then need to be assessed individually. Unfortunately, we're still at a point where we have substance abuse trained evaluators and mental health trained evaluators, and so we have some work to do in order to develop the skill sets for people to do these co-occurring assessments. We need to be very careful about attending to trauma-informed assessment, and we need to be thinking about individualized case plans and treatment matching that gets them to an effective integrated treatment. As I said before, better outcomes with higher levels of family engagement. This may mean that we need to broaden the definition of what counts as family. I'm a big believer in if the family thinks this person is family, it works for me. It doesn't necessarily have to be a biological parent or an aunt. What we are really looking for, the secret sauce in family engagement, is one positive adult who is willing to take an interest in supporting this child's recovery. And quite frankly, many of the families themselves, the caretaking parents, have their own substance abuse issues. And so waiting for them to sort of achieve stability is not going to help the child. And there are things that courts can do that we have listed under family-friendly practices. There's one court in Indiana that I think, I don't know how they did it, but they managed to have evening sessions one day a week so that parents who work during the day can attend. They start court at 7, they go till 9. We also need to involve parents with lived experiences as the team members in the juvenile drug treatment courts, and quite frankly from the very beginning as participants in designing the process. We need to avoid settling for what is available if it's inadequate. Something is not better than nothing in this particular case, because the stakes of failure, if you give a youth an intervention and they bomb out of it, are significant. This is the sort of thing that pushes them further into the juvenile justice system. So we kind of have to speak to the elephant in the room and truth to power to the judges that simply sending a kid off to generic treatment is likely not to be particularly helpful and actually may be a setup for the kid. This means that all of us need to begin thinking about capacity building for evidence-based integrated treatment. And in the real world, this often means bringing insurers and other funders into the picture, because these youth become very expensive very quickly from a lifetime behavioral and medical costs point of view, and that's before you add in the cost of them penetrating the adult criminal justice system, which they do at a very high rate. We also need to pay attention to the fact that mental disorders have a waxing and waning course of symptoms. Even when somebody is involved in treatment, especially in the early phases of treatment, we need to think carefully. For example, if a child is not going to school, is that because we have a willful child who is refusing the orders of the court? Or is this a child whose depression, for example, is not yet sufficiently resolved? They simply can't mobilize themselves for daily activities on a consistent basis. So we need to have violations and sanctions and rewards, for that matter, that focus on engagement rather than fluctuations of function that may be due to relapse or to symptom, although we want to see evidence of engagement to be sure. Ordinarily, we should hold youth with co-occurring disorders to the same criteria as those with either mental or substance use disorder. But as I was saying before, we need to consider the functional impact of active mental disorders that are beyond the control of youth. And the ultimate markers of this success are really active participation, evidence of substance use recovery over time. We want to see them stabilizing in their environments. And, of course, from a court's point of view, We want to see reduced rearrests or violations of expectations. Although we sometimes use the terms interchangeably, the words treatment and rehabilitation don't mean the same thing. Treatment may be a component of rehabilitation, or it may not. We're trained to think about treatment. Judges are trained to think about rehabilitation. And so we need to keep those two concepts separate in our mind, especially when talking to legal professionals. So there are emerging models. They're promising, but they're still developing. They will require key modifications in the policies which have been adopted through the experience of adult drug courts, and the key component is actually getting them to an evidence-based treatment for a co-occurring disorder. And those are my thoughts, and on advice of counsel, I'll stop here. Are there any comments, questions? Yeah. That's a great question. The question was, what's the age range for youth that are eligible? That varies by court. Typically, what you'll see is around 13 to 17, trying to get to those mid-adolescents. The problem with trying to expand it much beyond that is that if you have programming that has youth that are as young as 9 and as old as 17, it's a little hard developmentally to sort of pull that off and match them to services. There's also a fairly high rate of self-desistance amongst kids who come in fairly early. They have one bite at the apple. It wasn't nearly as much fun as they thought it was going to be. So these are youth who, yeah. I mean, there are two challenges in doing the research here. One is that most kids who come into contact with the juvenile court don't come back. So the real interesting question are, who are the frequent flyers? Co-occurring disorder kids are very much amongst the frequent flyers. But even they, as they mature, as they get older, tend to self-desist almost no matter what we do. And so in a way, we're trying to do research on outcome against a tide of self-desistance that's happening anyway. So it's tough. But the short answer to your question is usually around 13 to 17. Other comments or questions? Yeah.
Can you allude to the relationship between ACEs and the prevalence of co-occurring disorders?
Yes.
I just had a session where the panel was talking about these different issues, and it just seems like we should be pulling this all together as far as childhood trauma and ACEs leading to mental health problems and homelessness and even partner violence and the co-occurring disorders and the problems in the juvenile system, the court system.
I couldn't agree more. I think that the ACEs research, once people understand what the implications of this research is, it's a game changer. It's entirely a game changer. It's enough of a game changer that 5 years ago, 10 years ago, there were very few public health authorities that were doing standard prevalence studies of ACEs as part of their public health surveillance. When I last looked, there's about 16 now. It's almost like following the wave of tracking obesity. For a long time, we didn't track obesity, and then a few states did, and then all of a sudden people figured out we really wanted to know about this stuff. Some of the cutting-edge states on beginning to do ACEs surveillance, and it's turned out really, really well in terms of public informing public policy, have been states like Washington State. ACEs is the Adverse Childhood Experiences Study. It was done some years ago with an insured population in Southern California, Kaiser Permanente. It was essentially Kaiser Permanente and the Centers for Disease Control trying to figure out who are the people who are expensive medically by the time they hit middle age. And almost entirely by accident, because of the insistence of two physicians in the morbid obesity clinic, ironically enough, they added 10 questions. Did any of these things happen to you prior to your 18th birthday? So did you have a parent who was incarcerated? Did you have a parent who was an alcoholic or addicted to drugs? Did you see a maternal caregiver victimized by violence? All this sort of stuff. And lo and behold, it turned out that the answers to those 10 questions correlated very highly with this whole trajectory of risk. Early risk sexual behaviors, early onset drug and alcohol use, more likely to have a psychotic disorder, more likely to have a depressive disorder, this entire wave of bad news to the point where you could almost begin putting all these pieces together on a developmental risk trajectory, and where we got some astonishingly interesting hints about the neurobiology of adversity in childhood. For example, your health outcome for ischemic heart disease correlates more highly with the absolute number of ACEs that you have had than your current health-related behavior, which suggests that part of what's going on in chronic exposures to adversities is essentially a biological reset of some sort, which we've had some hints at for a long time, but have never really had a good conceptual model for what might be driving this. So I couldn't agree more. Any last comments or questions? Yes. I think if we were to, for example, administer the ACEs the way that we do the Youth Risk Behavior Survey and sort of put those data together, because when they did the survey in Washington, for example, you're not going to be wildly surprised to hear this. Some zip codes have a higher prevalence of ACEs than other zip codes. Some schools have higher prevalences. Some classrooms have higher prevalences. So looking at the difference in ACEs scores in kids in special ed versus kids in general ed, even in the same school, I mean, there's a non-random distribution of frequency and intensity of childhood exposure to adversity that I think would inform a lot of our decision making. Thank you
so much.